Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're looking at a business phenomenon, really, but one wrapped up in pop stardom.
We're talking Taylor Swift.
Exactly. Not just the world's biggest artist, but also a self-made billionaire. And what's fascinating is that her fortune comes almost entirely from, well, her music.
Songwriting, recording, touring, it's pretty much unheard of at this scale in modern music, that specific focus.
Right. And our sources, they really lay out the tactical roadmap here.
Yeah, this isn't just about talent or luck. It's a deep dive into resilience, smart strategy, how she basically rewrote the music industry rulebook for herself.
So the goal here is to pull out the actionable stuff, the business intelligence you can maybe apply yourself.
Precisely. Let's get into it.
Okay, so where does this empire even start? The sources point to this incredible, almost relentless determination right from the beginning.
It's quite the origin story. Age 11, walking around Nashville, handing out demo tapes.
But getting rejected by every major label.
Every single one. But that didn't deter her. If anything, it seemed to, you know, solidify her resolve. She wasn't just hoping. She was strategizing.
She even convinced her family to move.
To Hendersonville, Tennessee. Yeah. To be right in the heart of it all. Immerse herself in that music scene.
Wow. And it worked. Publishing deal by 14.
Yep. And a record contract by 15. That led straight to her debut album in 2006. Just incredibly fast.
Which brings us to maybe the first big tactic. Becoming a master storyteller.
Yeah.
Like right out of the gate.
Absolutely fundamental. Her early country songs, they felt like they were pulled straight from her diary.
First crushes, high school drama, heartbreak. Really specific stuff.
Uh-huh. And that's key. By age 16, she wasn't just writing songs. She was crafting relatable narratives. It's more than just music. It's emotional connection.
Like vulnerability is a strategy.
You could say that. Listeners felt like they knew her, like they were reading a friend's most private thoughts. That builds immense loyalty.
And the numbers showed it immediately, right? Their first album.
40,000 copies first week. Because it wasn't just her story. It felt like everyone's story.
Okay, so she blurred that line between the artist and the audience.
Exactly. Her life became the narrative, this ongoing saga that millions felt, you know, deeply invested in. That kind of loyalty, that's brand power. She basically wrote herself into the fabric of culture.
And commercially, she just took off, dominated country music.
Fearless wins album of the year. Speak Now breaks sales records for a female country artist. I mean, just massive success.
But then she pivots, calculates a change.
It started subtly with Red in 2012. You heard those pop hooks creeping in alongside the country sound, testing the waters, maybe.
But 1989 and 2014, that was the big one.
Oh, yeah. A clean break. Full-on pop. It was a huge gamble.
I remember that. The critics were saying, will her country fans follow? Is she abandoning her roots?
There was real concern she'd alienate the base that built her. But it was a strategic evolution, right? Betting on the loyalty being to her, not just the genre label.
And the bet paid off. Instantly.
Massively. 1989 sold over 10 million copies globally. One album of the year at the Grammys again.
Making her the first woman to win that award twice.
Correct. It proved the connection was deeper than just sound. It was about her voice, her stories.
Which sort of cemented this next big idea, this tactic too. The eras.
Ah, yes. The eras. Fans didn't just get albums, they got whole new worlds.
Each one with its own look, its own sound, its own aesthetic.
Yeah.
But still recognizably her.
And from a business perspective, this is genius. It's a repeatable system. Think of it like scheduled product launches.
Okay, yeah. Creates anticipation.
Exactly. Fans expect the reinvention. They get excited for it. It builds this cycle of hype, engagement, and, well, revenue. Merch, tours, everything.
So it's not just one product drop. It's like a subscription to cultural moments.
Perfectly put. It keeps the core engaged, brings in new fans with each era, and guarantees she's part of the cultural conversation every couple of years.
That cycle built the foundation for, well, everything that came next.
But that level of success, it often attracts, let's say, turbulence. Uh-huh. The backlash eventually came, and it got personal. Public feuds.
The Kanye West stuff, starting way back in 2009, but then really exploding again in 2016.
Right. Over his song Famous. Then Kim Kardashian released those phone call snippets.
And suddenly, the narrative completely flipped. The internet branded her a liar. Taylor Swift is over party. Was trending worldwide.
It was brutal. A really coordinated attempt, it seemed, to just cancel her.
And she vanished for about a year.
Total silence. Then she comes back with Reputation. And she doesn't shy away from it. She leans into the snake imagery, turns it into a symbol of resilience.
But while all that public drama was happening, something else was going on behind the scenes, right? Something about ownership.
Yes. The master's battle. This is crucial. While she was navigating the public fallout, the ownership of her first six albums, her entire back catalog up to that point, was sold.
Without her knowledge, to someone she publicly opposed, Scooter Braun.
Right. Now, we need to understand the nuts and bolts here. When she signed her first record deal at 15, 16.
Like most artists starting out.
Exactly. She gave up the rights to her master recordings.
Okay, break that down simply. What's the difference between masters and, say, publishing?
Good question. Two key rights. Publishing is the song itself, the lyrics, the melody, the composition. She wrote her songs, so she generally owned or controlled the publishing side. That's a huge asset in itself.
So she owned the intellectual property, the words and music?
Largely, yes. But the masters. That's the specific sound recording of the song that you hear on the radio or streaming, the final product created in the studio.
And the record label typically owns those?
Traditionally, yes. Because they funded the recording, the marketing, distribution, etc. So when her original label sold those first six albums masters, they were selling the actual recordings.
For the business guys, maybe just a transaction. But for her?
It was her life's work. Her diary, her identity, as the sources put it, sold off. It was deeply personal.
And that crisis, that feeling of betrayal, led to her next major strategic move.
Tactic three, you are the value. She realized the power wasn't just in those original tapes. It was in her, her voice, and her connection with the fans.
So she announced this plan, completely out of left field at the time.
Unprecedented, really. In 2020, she said she would re-record albums 1 through 5, calling them Taylor's versions.
Wasn't that seen as incredibly risky? Like redoing years of work? Would people even care?
Oh, the risk was enormous. Would fans bother switching? Would streaming platforms prioritize the new ones? Could she even recapture the magic? No one had tried this on this scale before.
She was essentially trying to devalue the asset someone else had bought her own original work.
By creating a better, more authentic alternative and rallying her fan base to support it.
And they did, massively.
The fans mobilized, streamed the new versions, ignored the old ones, fearless. Taylor's version debuted at number one on Billboard. It proved it could be done.
It wasn't just about artistic control then. It was, well, brilliant business.
Pure genius. Turning loss into leverage. Look at Red, Taylor's version. She adds, from the vault track, songs that didn't make the original cut.
Like the 10-minute All Too Well.
Which became a phenomenon, a cultural event, a number one single, all from a re-recording project. She basically turned personal history into a billion-dollar renewable resource.
So she didn't just get her work back. She created new value, entirely under her control, from music the industry thought was locked down.
She proved the artist is the commodity, the fans follow the storyteller, and she made sure she was the only one telling her story authentically. She bent the industry to her will.
Which leads us to the ultimate expression of that fan loyalty and her control. Tactic 4, architect of community and industry bypass.
And the prime example, the Eras Tour.
Which wasn't just a tour, was it? It became something else entirely.
A cultural earthquake. The biggest event of the decade, arguably. Grossing over $2 billion globally. It was pure community building on an unbelievable scale.
The sources talk about fans trading friendship, bracelets, the outfits, the rituals.
Yeah, it became participatory. Fans weren't just attendees. They were part of the show, part of a global movement she'd cultivated for years.
And she leveraged that movement strategically, right?
Yeah.
Especially with the concert film.
Absolutely. A masterclass in bypassing the old systems. Instead of using a traditional Hollywood studio for distribution.
Which would take a huge cut.
A massive cut. Often 50%, sometimes much more, goes to the distributor and various middlemen before the theater even takes its share.
Okay. So what does she do?
She went direct, made an unprecedented deal straight with AMC Theaters.
Cutting out the studios completely.
Entirely. And the financial implications are staggering. The sources suggest the deal structure meant she and the theater chain split the revenue much more favorably. She likely kept, you know, upwards of 90% of the profit after the theaters cut.
Wow. So that film, which grossed over $260 million worldwide.
The vast majority of that flowed directly to her. She acted like her own studio, her own distributor, a multinational corporation unto herself.
Controlling the entire value chain.
Yep.
Masters, publishing, distribution.
Direct to consumer, scaled globally. It's remarkable.
So let's put it all together. The empire, By 2025, we're talking over $1.6 billion in valuation.
And again, the key thing. Unlike so many music billionaires who rely on fashion, tech, whatever.
Rihanna with Fenty, Dr. Dre with Beats.
Right. Her fortune is almost entirely tied to the music, songwriting, recording, performing.
Let's break down those components quickly. The catalog.
Valued around $600 million, significantly boosted by the success and ownership of Taylor's versions, she rebuilt that asset's value herself.
Then the touring, the real powerhouse.
Yeah, the Eras Tour alone added something like $800 million to her net worth. That shows the power of that community and scale.
And the film strategy.
Over $260 million, largely direct profit.
And she has substantial long-term assets, too.
Over $100 million in real estate homes in New York, Rhode Island, Nashville, L.A., smart diversification, but still secondary to the music empire.
It's this incredible paradox, isn't it? The vulnerable songwriter, the confessional artist.
It is also a razor-sharp strategist. A mogul who engineered this success through calculated decisions, resilience, and frankly, rewriting the rules. It wasn't luck.
So pulling out the key lessons for you listening. Master storytelling builds unbreakable loyalty. Create repeatable cultural moments, like the Eras. Know your own value is inherent, not just defined by a contract.
And leverage that community. Look for ways to bypass the traditional gatekeepers and go direct.
Taylor Swift's journey really shows that success can be, well, designed, engineered. She saw an industry standard, the artists losing their masters, and built a system to dismantle it.
Which leaves us with a question for you. What established rule, what that's just how it's done, norm exists in your own field, your own career?
Could you challenge it? Could you bypass it using similar strategic thinking and resilience? Something to think about.
Definitely something to mull over.
Well, that's our deep dive for today on how Taylor Swift didn't just build a career, she built an empire. Thanks for joining us.
We'll see you next time.